Thank you, Ellie, for that courageous read of one of your favorite gospel texts. Yes, murder, adultery, divorce. That's what we have on tap today. We were thinking of ways to drive people out of the church. This text came up. I didn't pick the text. You'll understand that these things aren't schedules, and this was the schedule for today. Fact is, it comes up every 3 years, right? So there are lots of sermons on the web if you want to look them up from what's it'd be 2020, so 2017, 2014, 20, you get it. So I was looking at all those old sermons, and one of the first ones that popped up was by a nice Lutheran pastor, and the title of her sermon was, "Uh-oh, Matthew 5, 21 to 37, it's back again." It makes me think about pulling up the covers and eating the ice cream, pulling covers over my head, yes. But I would point out, we are UCC, and the Bible is our book, and Jesus is our guy, and his story is, in some ways, also our story. So let's roll up the sleeves, let's do the passage, see if it really is the train wreck that it appears to be. Okay, did you notice we have three subjects today, and each of them begins more or less with the same words? You have heard that it was said to people long ago, but I tell you this. It's got a ring to it. It used to be this, now I tell you this. It used to be this, now I tell you this. There's a certain rhythm here in this text. And it's not just three sayings that are like that. There's actually three more sayings like that. We cut it short because we thought these first three would be plenty for one morning. There are six sayings altogether. Bible scholars like to call these the six antitheses of Jesus. Antithesis. In other words, when Jesus says, well, it used to be said, that's like the thesis or the main point. And then he says, oh, but I tell you now, that's like the antithesis, like Jesus' spin on the old, Jesus is riffing on the old points. Six antitheses. The whole question, at least in my thinking, is what is Jesus getting at here with this back and forth, back and forth? So here's some options. The first option, was Jesus setting aside the Ten Commandments in this sermon, which after 1,300 years may have seemed a little threadbare? 1,300 years before today would be the year 700. That's a long time to keep an ethical code. It's certainly a long time to keep a legal code. They've been great, but now they really need some sprucing up. Or, second option, was Jesus actually ratcheting up the Ten Commandments, raising the bar, so to speak, making a previously big challenge of the commandments into a positively huge challenge? Oh yes, and let's not forget, the Ten Commandments threatened us with death, but Jesus' passage threatens us with burning in hell forever. I mean, that's really a ratcheting up. Or, third option, is there some other thing going on here? Some truth that is not easily reduced to a few lines of text? Maybe it's not a little spruce up, and it's not a raising of the bar. Maybe Jesus was getting at some third thing that we must work pretty hard to get at. And importantly, we may wish to ask, does this have anything to do with us? So let's tackle the first antithesis. Loosely translated, loosely rendered, I suppose, it's this. You've heard it said, do not murder, but I tell you that even if you're angry with someone, you will be judged. If you say to someone, now forget now the word that you used in your reading, Ellie, was it fool? When it said, if you say to someone, If you call somebody...
I've blocked it out already.
I know. It would be right there in verse 21, if you say to someone something, you go to court, approximately.
Just answer for it to the court. If he sneers at
them. Oh, if you sneer at somebody. Oh, that's a good word. Sneer. Sneer. I like sneer. Yeah. Okay, well, to start off, Jesus notes here in this section that the Ten Commandments prohibits homicide. Good plan. Everybody knows this is an excellent scheme. We can't just have folks walking around with guns shooting each other. That would be a less good plan. Of course, if you wanted to, you could get into all kinds of discussions here on gun rights and capital punishment. Should that count as homicide? What about drone strikes, assassination? Oh, the water's getting muddy very fast. But let's zoom in on the word that Ellie read as sneer. If you sneer at somebody, you will end up in court. Religious court, this is. When I grew up, we had a King James Bible in the house. Fact is, I had one of my very own. It had a zipper on it. You could zip it up. It was black tulle leather. Cheap leather, but leather. And that Bible did not use the word sneer in this verse. Rather, it used the very ancient word raca. If you call your brother or sister raca, you will surely be hauled in before the court. That's R-A-C-A, raca. It's not English. It's not Greek. It's not Aramaic. It's a very ancient word, and one that was still being used in Jesus' time, but this just barely, from a language that had died 500 years ago. Chaldean. In fact, this word is so mysterious that a lot of translators won't even try to render it in English. They just leave it in the text, raca. For ancient Chaldeans, this word meant empty, much like an empty pot or an empty basket. And sometimes it could even mean a person who, feeling ill, has emptied the content of his or her stomach. That would be raca. By extension, the word also came to mean someone whose head is empty. Somebody addled. Somebody who has no proper understanding of things. Someone with nothing worth saying. And by Jesus' time, this word was not especially intensive, but it was most certainly condescending. It means writing someone off as their experience which just does not give them any proper judgment. So Jesus picked up this tiny little term to illustrate for his disciples that thinking about another as empty, unworthy of speaking, as being of no account, as being a trivial human being, or having no value, this attitude of the heart is much like that which we find in those preparing to take another's life. After all, the killer is the one who judges another as unworthy of continued existence, as raca. Let's look at the second antithesis. Again, rendering loosely, you've heard it said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you, anyone lusts who has already committed adultery in their heart, okay, lust, adultery, lust. You get the connection? Question. This is a real question. Can we commit adultery without having lust? Some people are shaking their heads yes. Some people are shaking their heads no. Can we commit adultery without having lust? Well, I feel these are not words they usually use here in a church. Can we commit adultery with him? Anybody want to say yes? Oh, most certainly we can. Oh, for sure, we can have sex with someone else's spouse prompted by lust. For sure, that's pretty straightforward. But we can also commit adultery prompted by anger, or jealousy, or boredom, by despair. We can even commit adultery prompted by hatred. Isn't that something? So while the Ten Commandments deal with a particular set of behaviors, Jesus uses the word lust to signify an internal attitude of the person, especially with respect to the partner. Now, a bit of language study here really is useful. The word that is in the text that gets translated as lust is actually, get this, a compound word. It's got two parts to it. And the first part is to concentrate upon, and the second part of the word is one's own feelings. So get this, if you're lusting after somebody, the way that this word works is not that you're thinking about that other person. Oh no, what this word shows us is that I am concentrating upon my own set of feelings. Utterly self-absorbed. So we're not talking about some random sexual impulse. We're talking about a deliberate and protracted meditation on our own inner states. To lust is to regard the potential partner as an object to be used to satisfy one's own drive. Objectification, that's what we would call it nowadays. And this is not limited to just sex. We have the capacity to lust for lots of types of human relationships. Lust for power. Lust for recognition. Lust for revenge. Lust for gratitude. And the list goes on and on. Do you notice here a similarity between this kind of lust and that term raka? Jesus added a special illustration just for those inclined to feed their lust and through visual stimulation. I suppose today's word would be pornography. If your right eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it away. Ellie read this with great relish. Now, it's been a long time, but I used to be in junior high. I really did. And back then, I belonged to a great Sunday school class. We were all guys, and we all knew how to be raucous. And over against that, we had a mild-mannered, gray-headed, bespectacled teacher, Mr. Baxter. And he was very kindly. He loved us, really. And we tried not to annoy him, because he was kind, and not too seriously, and not too often. But when we got to this passage in my zipper King James Bible, that was too much. It pushed us over the edge. Junior high boys in this straight-laced, tie-wearing, oh-so-pious Plymouth Brethren Church, we could no longer hold back, quietly at first, and then a little louder and a little louder, we would mimic the King James English, "Behold, friend, methinks thou eye doth offend. I shall pluck it out for thee." This did not amuse Mr. Baxter. He thought we were not taking the gospel seriously. He was right, I suppose. He was even less amused when we took to calling each other Raka. You've heard it said that anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate. This is the third antithesis. But I tell you that anyone who divorces already makes his wife a victim of adultery. Please note at the outset that this text is no place to go looking for what Jesus thought about marriage or fidelity or divorce. There's other places to do that. This particular saying is deeply culture-bound. and relates to a local problem in a moment of time, namely the alarming increase of heartless divorces, trivial, without cause. The text really does not attempt to offer any form of universal guideline, so this is not a good place to look for that. In fact, this observation of Jesus doesn't even go back to the Ten Commandments. It just goes back to a certain decision made to issue divorce certificates to widows to lighten up their lives post-divorce. And it sometimes worked, sometimes it didn't, but the point is that at the time Jesus lived, there was a lively debate about that whole certificate program going on among the priests. And so it was on people's minds. Jesus did not weigh into that debate. Rather, he focused on the man contemplating divorce for a trivial reason. And it was the men doing the divorcing here. I'm using it deliberately. What must that man have in his heart to seriously contemplate divorcing a woman, knowing what lay in front of her when she had done no substantial wrong? What is going on in that guy? We see that Jesus looked upon this groundless divorce with severity equal to that of adultery, even though one is legal and the other is not. As far as Jesus was concerned, these were equally serious aberrations. Both actions, because both actions, divorce and adultery, reveal the failure to fully appreciate the substance and dignity of the partner. Both actions regard the partner as trivial, as empty, as a zero. Both actions regard the partner as raka. Okay, we've done our homework. We reflected on all three antitheses. Let's go back to our first question. Number one, was Jesus trying to set aside the old religious law people had grown up with? Was he trying to say 10 commandments are outmoded? No, he was not. Was Jesus trying to ratchet up the old religious law that people had grown up with? Oh, the old way is too easy. This is a new harbor. No. No, I was not doing that. Third option. Is it this way? Jesus took aside his disciples and opened to them the inner workings of the old religious law with which they were so familiar. Wasn't Jesus, after all, showing his trusted followers, on the example of three lively present-day examples, what happens in the human heart that makes the law needful? No, most certainly. And what is this mysterious human attribute that Jesus was revealing? It is our common human capacity to regard someone as empty-headed, addled, as a human being has no understanding, a person with nothing to say, someone of no account. It is the readiness and the capacity to regard the other as the empty one, the raka. The implications are staggering. If Jesus saw fit to teach that, it means also that Jesus was confident that we could grow in our hearts to regard all people with respect and dignity. Jesus knew that because we can overcome our readiness to disregard others, because maybe they are anti-MAGA and I am pro. Or maybe they're pro-MAGA and I'm anti. It's not a reason to shut off the dignity of and to stop listening. Not at all. Well, you remember Mr. Baxter, my Sunday school teacher? I think he probably got this. I mean, how else could he put up with this gaggle of unruly junior high boys, you know, carrying on. I doubt that Mr. Baxter is still living. He'd probably be like 110 years old. But if he were, I would like to ask him, was there ever anyone that he dismissed as empty, as trivial, as Rocca? I dare not speak for you, of course, but I can confirm for myself that there are many voices I choose not to listen to because they come from directions which I do not value, and they're repeating messages that I heard before, and I'm inclined to shut my ears. Jesus thought that this dismissive behavior, this ear shutting, can be overcome. And I, for one, am happy for his confidence.